Good evening, everybody. Please feel free to get seats. There are more in the front here. You know, we say every day in davening, we give a bracha to the Ribbono Shel Olam, Ozir Yisrael B'Gvura, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu girds the Jewish people with Gvura, with strength. Rav Soloveitchik pointed out what is strength, Gvura, as opposed to Koach, that kind of strength. And he said that Koach is a physical strength, as opposed to Gvura. Gevura is an internal will, power, determination that helps drive us to overcome the odds. It is that willpower that the Mishnah Navos praises as Ezu Gibar Kovish Yisro. Who is the Gibor? Who is the hero? Someone who is able to overcome their Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. That aspect of Gevura, overcoming the evil inclination, is one that's difficult and is really at the heart of tonight's discussion. And I'd like to thank both Rabbi Twersky and Dr. Belkovitz for freeing up time to discuss this very vital, important topic with us. I'd just also like to note that there are little cards on the seats. People should feel free after presentations. There will be a question and answer, and people can pass up the cards if they want to ask a question that way, or we will certainly take people who are interested in just raising their hand. That works as well. Again, I'd like to thank Rabbi Twersky and Dr. Pelkovitz for taking their time and spending it with us. Thank you.
The speakers were arranged with the following rationale in mind, that I would speak first, and Dr. Pelkovitz could correct all my mistakes and set things straight. So with that in mind, let's begin. Any such presentation is going to naturally have two foci. There's going to be a perspective one, looking lahabo, and a retrospective one. The perspective one, looking lahabo, how we can avoid being nichshal, especially when we live in a society where one is just constantly bombarded by pritzus, by images of pritzus. And the retrospective vantage point, the retrospective perspective, how are we supposed to relate to past failures, and what, in a very practical halacha lemaisa level, are we supposed to do about it? Now, the truth is there's a certain tension between these two perspectives. Looking lahaba, perspectively, how to avoid being nichshal in these areas, and looking back retrospectively, if one has been nichshal, what we do about it. And the reason for this tension is that in thinking about chait prospectively, and thinking about the prospect or possibility of chait, so our attitude has to be that chait is something which is unthinkable. It's unthinkable. How can it be if HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us that this is something which is wrong, this is something which is very wrong, so it has to be unthinkable. The retrospective perspective obviously is that chait happens and has happened. And there is a certain tension, but a tension but not a contradiction between those two. And the reason for that is that we recognize that although chait should be unthinkable, on the other hand, the Yetzer Hara is something which is a very, very potent force. And while Chazal tell us that Ein Adam Chotei Elam Kein Nichnas Baruach Shus, that on one level it's the ultimate irrational behavior for a person to be Chotei, but we're very susceptible to Ruach Shus. So in a word, Chet is unthinkable, But the unthinkable happens. And there's no contradiction between those two. Both the Rambam and the Ramban comment on the Pasuk in Tehillim of Ki Imcha Haslicha Leman Tivare. Right? So what's the translation of the Pasuk? That forgiveness is with you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in order that you should be feared. So what's the how does that follow? What's the logical sequence there? So both the Rambam and the Ramban say that were it not for the prospect of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's forgiveness, were it not for the prospect of that HaKadosh Baruch Hu accepting our tshuva, so then we would all be Messiahish. Because everyone is nechshal in something. Okay, Yechves, Binyamin, Yishai, you can meet a few individuals who are not nechshal, but they're few and far between. The rest of us are nechshal. Were it not for the prospect of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's forgiveness, were it not for the fact Ki Imcha Haslicha, so we would all give up, we would all despair. So Ki Imcha Haslicha L'man Tivari, that we shouldn't despair. So with that, let's segue into the retrospective in terms of what our attitude is, L'sha'avar, when a person looks back and is aware that he has been nechshal. Whether we're talking about nichshal in Zera Levatola, whether we're talking about nichshal in terms of voluntarily viewing all kinds of inappropriate images and visual stimuli, or whatever the case may be. I think that the natural reaction, which we need to know what to do with, is that a person is obviously a Ben Torah, someone, if we aspire to be Bnei Torah, is obviously going to feel very ashamed, especially in this area. And there is very real potential for that shame, Rachmana Litzlan, to lead to a sense of Yeyush, a sense of despair, a sense of giving up. And also, there's very real potential that because of that shame, a person may be inhibited from seeking guidance and help from, be it a Rav, be it a mental health professional. So let's address each of those points. The danger of Yeyush, that because of the shame that one feels, that one... and the guilt that one, Rachman Litzlan, can be a Messiah, as well as the shame inhibiting one from reaching out for the guidance and help that is needed. The Rambam quotes from Chazal in Perek Beis of Hilchos Tshuva. The Rambam talks about different time frames for Tshuva. He talks about what the most optimal time for tshuva is. It's basically ba'osa zman, ba'osa makom. Then the Rambam says, even if the case is that afilu ova kol yomav, va'osa tshuva b'yom yisasa, even if a person, his whole life, was over a virus, and doesn't do tshuva until the day of his death, Rachmana Litzlan. However, von meis b'tshuvasa, but he dies from in a state of tshuva, in a state of repentance. So kol avonosav nimchalim, all his sins are forgiven. So to sort of elicit from this Rambam the lesson that we need, so I'd like to share with you a story that my brother told me he heard on a tape from a cousin of ours in Eretz Yisrael. The story goes as follows. This Rav, he's in his youth was Meshamesh, the Gerei Rebbe, the Beis Yisrael. He once received a letter from a friend of his. here in Chutz Laaretz, telling him that he was dealing with the following very serious situation and was simply at a loss as to what to do. That someone had come to him and he had this powerful urge to shmad, had this powerful urge, Rahmanu Litzlan, for apostasy. I assume it meant Christianity. And what do you do with it? So he presented the question to the Geri Rebbe, to the Beis Yisrael. The Beis Yisrael, his sense of empathy for a fellow Jew who was struggling with such a terrible Yetzer Hara, such a terrible predicament, so he was very agitated. And he began pacing back and forth. After a couple of minutes of pacing, so he asks this Rav Weinberg, he asked for a Gemara Shabbos. He says, give me a Gemara Shabbos, please. He brings him the Gemara Shabbos. He opens the Gemara Shabbos, and he opens it to the Maimah Chazal, that if a person answers, Omen Yehei Shmei Rabbah V'chol Kocho, is Afilu Odar Avodah Zorah Kedor Shel Onosh is Mochon Lo. If a person answers to Kaddish, Omen Yehei Shmei Rabbah V'chol Kocho, Rashi and Tosfos, whether B'chol Kochel means with all the kavana, with all the concentration he can muster, or whether it means just loudly, he projects his voice. So even if he's been tainted by involvement with Avodah Zarah, such as in the generation of Enosh, is Mochelma. So the Geri Rebbe turns to him and says to him in Yiddish, what do you learn from this Gemara? So he says, well, you learn from this Gemara, that even if a person has been implicated in Avodah Zarah, like the generation of Enosh, but he answers Omen Yehi Shmei Rabbah with all his strength, he's forgiven. So the Geri Rebbe says, no. So now that's what the Gemara says. What do you learn from this Gemara? He says, I don't know. So the Geri Rebbe tells him, what you learn from this Gemara is that even though a person has been Oved Avodah Zarah, Kedor Shel Enosh, even though he's been involved with Avodah Zarah, like the generation of Enosh, he's still capable of answering Amen Yehi Shmei Rabbah V'chol Kocha. Despite that involvement, despite the fact that he has sinned in that way, he retains that capacity to answer Amen Yehi Shmei Rabbah V'chol Kocha. A tremendous, tremendous insight of the Beis Yisrael. If we transpose that insight to this din, which the Rambam quotes from Chazal, that afilu ova kol yomav v'asa tshuva b'yom yisaso, and will patterning ourselves, modeling ourselves on the Beis Yisrael's analysis, will ask, what's the limud? What do you learn from this Gemara? What do you learn from this halacha? So what we learn from this halacha is that no matter how much a person has been involved in chait, he still has that capacity to be chozer v'tshuva. He still has that capacity to genuinely, profoundly change and do tshuva. And the Rambam is talking about the extreme case. This may be an old man who was mired in chait for decades and decades. Alachas kama v'kama, when one is speaking in such a forum to young people, so the first thing to realize is that no matter what has happened, so a person has that koach to be chozer v'tshuva. There's a famous vort from the Kotzke Rebbe. Some for many people, this is the first daf Gemara that they learn is in Eilim Metzias, the Machlokas Abayi and Rava about Yeyah Shalom Midas. So what it means literally is, if you lost an object, you're not aware of the fact that you lost it. Had you been aware, so you would have given up hope of retrieving it, but lamaisa, you're not really aware. So does that sort of, do you lose your claim to the object? Do you lose your ownership or not? So in that, so that situation is described as yeyush shalom idas. It's a yeyush which didn't really, it's giving up hope, which didn't really play itself out on a conscious level. Yeyush shalom idas. So from the Kotzke Rebbe, they say that Yeyush, that a person should be Messiah, that a person should give up, is always Shalom Midas. That's something which Shalom Midas, it's not something which exists in our vocabulary. And there's no exception to it. The area, the sensitive area which we're discussing this evening, is no exception to this rule that Yeyush is Shalom Midas. It's no exception to this rule, again, to the Limud, again, inspired by the Beis Yisrael's insight that we culled, that a person has the capacity for tshuva. There's no room, no cause, no reason for a person to be Messiah. What about the other issue, the issue of the feeling of shame and the possibility that might inhibit a person from seeking guidance from a Rav, a psychologist? So here, I think the following needs to be said. Now, the truth is that a feeling of shame is a very crucial component to doing tshuva. That we can't do tshuva if we don't feel shame. When the Rambam tells us what the quintessential formulation or definition of vidui is, and the vidui reflects what the tshuva is, so it's boshti v'nechamti, right? That the person says nechamti boshti b'masai asisi kach v'kach. I did such and such, whatever the kach v'kach is. Nichamti uboshti, and ulaolam eini chozer l'davazeh. So the Rambam has all of 8 words, 10 words, and in that context, the Rambam says boshti. So we do have to feel shame. So Yahadus doesn't agree that all feelings of shame or guilt are destructive. No, there is such a thing as a very healthy and warranted sense of shame. There is such a thing as a healthy and warranted sense of guilt. On the other hand, shame and guilt obviously can be paralyzing. They can be crippling also if a person feels it too intensely. So how does a person find the right balance? So how much shame is a person supposed to feel when we think about our chatoy? So probably a good rule of thumb is as much as can be channeled productively. To the extent that the shame will lead me again to have a profound sense of remorse, but then to move beyond it and it galvanizes me to do tshuva. We'll talk a little bit more specifically about what that means. So that type of shame should be present. We are supposed to feel shame. But the very minute the shame is something which is inhibiting, so then that's already excessive. And it's not necessarily the case that, obviously you can't quantify feelings and emotions, but even if we could, it's not necessarily the case that the quotient of shame or guilt is going to be the same for every person. It could be that for one person, is going to have one threshold of how much shame and guilt he can use and experience productively, and beyond that, it becomes something destructive for him. And that's absolutely not what Boshti v'Nechlamti is about. Boshti v'Nechlamti is supposed to lay the foundation for La'olam Eini Chozer L'Dor V'Zeh. It's not that a person, Rachman al-Itzlan, is supposed to get stuck at that stage. So what the quotient of Busha is something which is going to vary from yachid to yachid. It's dvarim hamesurim alev, but the rule of thumb is that it has to be something, again, that it's uncomfortable is fine. It should be uncomfortable. Tshuva is uncomfortable. And when we said that there's no reason for Yayush, it doesn't necessarily mean that the tshuva is easy. It's not easy, but it's doable. It's attainable. It's within our reach. Lam dafka easily. Lam dafka that we can coast to it. And so too, the threshold is not, oh, it's uncomfortable for me to think about it. No, the threshold is it productive? Is it something that I can use to galvanize myself, to strengthen my resolve? Or is it something that's becoming paralyzing and crippling, Rachmana Litzlan? Just a couple of other perspectives in terms of dealing with the shame and having perspective on it. One of the reasons, or one of the elements of experiencing shame, is that a person feels very much alone in that experience of shame. By definition, because it's such a private and personal experience, it's not something that one does or gratuitously should compare notes with others about. And as a result, so when we feel ashamed about something, we feel very much alone. So it's important to know, again, not in a way of eliciting complacency, but it's important to know that many, many people struggle with these issues. Many, many people have been nechshama on these issues. And that when we think about that, so we should know, again, that we're not alone. And again, it's not sanua. It shouldn't be a topic of casual conversation. It should only be, again, for necessary tachlis. But it is important to know that these are issues which confront many, many people, and that many, many people struggle with it, and that should help dispel that sense of aloneness. Another perspective in terms of if, as needed and as recommended, one reaches out, be it to a rav, be it to a psychologist, so you have to know that any bona fide rav, any bona fide psychologist, is not sitting and listening and forming judgments about the person who comes to him. A rav, a psychologist, is there to help. He's not there to form judgments, and that's not what's happening in his mind. He's not thinking, I can't believe it. I can't believe that this person did such a thing. I can't believe that this person has such an issue. It's the furthest thing from his mind. A, he's there, he's focused on helping. B, anyone, any rav or psychologist worth his salt understands well enough that to judge someone else, you have to be perfect. Judging is the Ribbono Shel Olam's prerogative. It's not our prerogative. When a psychologist hears of someone else's struggles, so he's also human. He also knows that he has his struggles. They may be the same, they may be different. It doesn't make a difference. But he doesn't see himself as being any better than the person who's approaching him. And if he's in a position to help, that's all he's interested in doing. When someone goes to a rav, to a psychologist, he's not being judged. There are no negative impressions being formed. The context and the mindset is that people are here to help each other. And this is one context in which we try to do so. But we mentioned a few times about speaking to a rav, a psychologist. So how do you know who to go to? Let's say a person has in this area, there are other areas where the question can come up as well. Is it basically a religious issue? So therefore, one should turn for guidance to one's Rebbe. If he is capable and adept at dealing with such issues, not dafka that every Rav or Rebbe is, or does one turn to a psychologist?
So I'll let Dr. Pelkovitz have the last word on this, but I would just suggest maybe one or two criteria to look at. First of all, and again, we'll take the example of Zara Levatala. The same thing could be pornography or any of the related issues. A person can have a Yetzirah, which has been machshel him however many times, or it can rise to the level of an addiction. That these types of behaviors can become addictive. I would think that certainly in the latter situation, when it's not just the question of a Yetzirah that a person is struggling with and isn't consistently successful in overcoming, but where he has reason to think that perhaps it may have reached the level of addictive behavior, so then clearly one's Rav, one's Rebbe is not the only address in such a case, and one certainly would and should benefit from professional guidance as well. The second factor that comes to mind is in thinking about the issue, sometimes these issues, again, pornography, Zara Levatala, whatever it may be, sometimes they're part of a broader package. Dahainu. That sometimes, in addition to struggling with an issue of viewing pornography or something like that, so a person may have other, it may be part of a broader package. A person may suffer from acute sense of loneliness. There may be depression. Okay, so it could be the depression is just a fallout from the guilt of being involved with that. But even if that's the case, when these issues are not isolated, not self-contained, it's probably a good bet that one would benefit from some insight and guidance from a mental health professional as well. Before the Rabbonim accused me of putting them out of business, L'chara, a Rav's input is always appropriate, because whatever other elements or dimensions there may be to these issues, but it certainly always remains a religious issue as well. It may, in addition, be a mental health issue, but it certainly remains a religious issue as well in terms of how to go about doing tshuva and the like. So certainly, it's appropriate to find again an appropriate rav or a personal rebbe, whomever, to consult. Reb Moshe has a tshuva in Igros Moshe and Or HaChaim in Chelek Dalet, where he suggests a regimen for tshuva. I think he talks about that in the first year that a person is trying to do tshuva, he recommends that maybe a person should fast once every 2 months, and then he says in the second year maybe it should be once every 3 months, and in the third year it should just be twice a year, and that's all he recommends in terms of Taniyos. And he says, and the ikur is that in addition to, again, the articulating to HaKadosh Baruch Hu this profound sense of regret, that the main area of activism, he says, even more than the Taniyos, in his opinion, should be that a person should be meschazek in Talmud Torah. Now, clearly there are other approaches. We're in the time of year now of Shovavim, so clearly those Rabbonim who draw more from Kabbalah sources, what Moshe was drawing more from Nigla sources, have different approaches, and probably that's something that a person can and should talk to his personal Rebbe about in terms of what approach to take to tshuva. Very quickly, in talking Lahabah, in terms of how we seek to combat the Yetzer Hara and to try to avoid the pitfalls and being nichshal. So I think the key word of the Torah's approach here, of Chazal's approach, is that the Torah, Chazal, are very realistic in anything to do with dealing with the Yetzer Haras. Meaning, the Torah doesn't have a notion, that since we emphasize the importance and the centrality of Kedoshim Tiyu, that means we sort of pretend that people don't have Yetzer Haras and we pretend that these things don't exist. No, there are some people who do that, and they tell their clerics not to get married, and then it makes the front pages of the newspapers what they do when they're put in that unrealistic situation. So the Torah Chazal are very realistic. Particularly here, being realistic means two things. A, it means Chazal say, the Rambam quotes, that Ein lecha davar b'chol haTorah kula shu kosher l'rov ha'am lifrosh ela min ha'arayos v'habiyos ha'asuros. That may be the most powerful Yetzer Hara that we have, maybe the most powerful and instinctive drive that we have is in the area of arayos, and we have to recognize it as such. The Rambam also quotes that Omul Chachamim that Gezel v'Arayos Nafsha Shel Odom Mis'aver Lohen U'Mechamdosan. That Arayos, again, illicit relations and that which comes with the territory. So a person desires it. A person craves it. In Tefillah Zakah we talk about the Yetzer Hara. We compare it to an Eish Haboa Ba'atzmosa. It's like a fire burning inside of my bones. So that's the first element, the first note of realism, to just know that internally, regardless of in what society a person lived or at what point in history we would be living, it's just a very, very powerful drive and urge and Yetzer Hara that we all have. The second note of realism is to realize the constant provocation to which we're subjected and to which we can easily be subjected given the society in which we live. Basically, the society in which we live is obsessed with matters relating to intimate relations. Most of what's referred to as humor is just nivel peh about such matters. A lot of what's supposedly popular culture also is obsessed with this, and because of that, it just surrounds us. And that note of realism is also necessary. So what do we do with these notes of realism? Okay, so duly noted. Duly noted that there is a very powerful internal Yetzer Hara. Duly noted that there is a very powerful external stimulus given the time and the day and the age in which we live. So now what? So the Avos Dor Ibnosan says that the Torah tells us, the Torah itself tells us we have to make siyogim. The Avos Dor Ibnosan says the paradigm for that is from the Sikri Vulagalos Erva. That even though, as it were, the Torah is interested in preventing forbidden relations, but nevertheless, the Torah says that one shouldn't even engage in chibuk v'nishuk, in kissing, in hugging, and any physical manifestation of romantic feeling or interest with someone with whom one is not supposed to have such relationships, such relations. The Mesilas Yesharim, I think, gives a different source for this idea that we have to establish fences for ourselves, that we have to adopt precautionary measures. He says that by a nazir, what the Torah is really interested in is that the nazir shouldn't drink wine. That's really what the Torah is interested in. And nevertheless, the Torah says he can't touch grapes, he can't consume grapes, he can't consume any grape product, even if it doesn't have any alcoholic content, even if it isn't wine. And he says, again, the Torah is establishing a paradigm that the way one avoids something is by taking precautionary measures. Specifically, when you deal with a Yetzer Hara, Chazal understood very, very well that the easiest way to combat the Yetzer Hara is not to allow the Yetzer Hara to be inflamed, not to allow the Yetzer Hara to be provoked or stimulated. Why is it when people want to make fun of Orthodox Jews and how crazy and extreme and draconian they are, they talk about how an engaged couple, they can't even hold hands. I haven't heard anything so crazy and medieval and so what the answer is? The answer is that Chazal, the Torah, understood very well that on a scale of 1 to 10, whatever number you'll assign to the Yetzer Hara for an engaged couple to hold hands, let's call it a 2. Okay, so it's a Yetzer Hara. It's like a Yetzer Hara, and it's a Yetzer Hara, which Rabbi Bacon spoke about Gevura, that we need to prevail over the Yetzer Hara. But if an engaged couple holds hands, so then the Yetzer Hara to proceed to the next step, the next stage, is not a 2 on the Yetzer Hara scale. It's going to be higher than a 2. And the more provocation there is, the more inflammation that there is of the Yetzer Hara, so then the harder and harder it becomes to overcome, and the harder it becomes to cope with it. So because of that, that's why the Torah has this notion of siyagim. So what does siyagim mean? What does it mean practically in this context? It means that we have to try as much as possible to be careful about Shmira Sainayim, to be careful about what we see, what kind of visual images we see, and to the extent that that's under our control, to exercise that control. We have to be careful about what kinds of books we read, that one's thoughts can be stimulated and provoked in the wrong direction by reading Divrei Cheshek, by reading descriptions of romantic encounters or the like. That also, again, it's a din in Shulchan Aruch. It's not a siyag that we have to create for ourselves, but also it's something which is very, very relevant in this context. In a more positive vein, not just in terms of what it is that we try to avoid, again, in terms of inappropriate images that we shouldn't see, inappropriate provoking, stimulating inappropriate thoughts by reading and seeing the wrong things. The Rambam tells us at the end of Hilchos Yisurei Biyah that the Yetzer Hara comes when there's a vacuum. And the more positively engaged and preoccupied a person is, be it with Divrei Torah, be it with, again, if for whatever reason that's not appropriate at the time, but the more positively engaged and preoccupied a person is, so then the less of a vacuum there is and the less room there is for the person to start engaging and in all kinds of inappropriate thoughts which can head in the wrong direction. And finally, there's much more to say, but I already went much too long. Finally, the Maseilas Yesharim has an idea that in addition to whatever siyagim, whatever precautionary safeguards Chazal imposed that are binding on all of us, a person should make his own personal siyagim. If a person knows that he has a weakness in a certain area, so he should take a precaution. There's no obligation to cover your light switches before Shabbos. But if a person knows that reflexively, he often, when he walks out of a room, he'll flip the light switch, and it's happened to him. He did it once in Shabbos, did it twice in Shabbos, so then he should realize that he has a weakness in this area, and then the Maseilas Yesharim says he should adopt a personal siyag. So for him, he should be covering his light switches. So if a person knows, again, either based on past experience or just he knows with the inner struggle which is being waged with inside of him, that he has, again, that he's struggling with these issues. So clearly, how one uses the internet, where one uses the internet, is something where one can fulfill this mandate of the Mesillas Yesharim of self-imposed siyagim. So, for instance, whether it's a filter which keeps certain sites off the internet, or whether it's to only use it in public areas where everyone can see whatever I'm viewing, everyone can look over my shoulder to see what I'm viewing. So one would use the internet in the library, not in one's dorm room. One has to look for these type of personal siyagim as well to help him in again trying to preempt and to be mizgabe, to prevail against the Yetzer Hara when it's still lower on the scale, rather than once it's already inflamed and instigated.
I'm very struck by in anything like this how there's such obvious consonance between, I think, everything we just heard and the wisdom of Torah and what the most current research in psychology is showing. Let me even start with first just a thought about the word busha. The word busha and the two kinds of busha that psychologists talk about. This last week's Haftorah, there's a pasuk that talks about Sisera's mother being worried that he's not coming back. And there's the term, I think, kiboshesh milavo. Similar, there's a word like that when Bnei Yisrael are worried, kiboshesh Moshe, from coming back from the har, in terms of with the luchos. And what this has to do with psychologically is that the word busha, in terms of the positive busha, is tied to the word yavesh, a break in the flow. Break in the flow is what positive shame is about. It's a very necessary break in the flow of our action. It's a pause. So a lot of what it takes to be human is the pause in our action where we think to ourselves, are we better than this? Is this worthy of our goals? Is it worthy of what we stand for? And that kind of busha psychologically is basically what psychologists call behavioral self-blame. There are two kinds of self-blame. One is characterologic self-blame, where you say, I'm doing something wrong. It means I'm a terrible, awful, broken, horrible, miserable person. That paralyzes. Okay, so the characterologic self-blame is associated with depression. It's associated actually with not getting any better. Behavioral self-blame in the research is where you say, am I better than this? It's the busha. It's the break in the flow, which is exactly what's associated with what brings so many of you out here tonight. It's sort of like a chance to take a step back. Viktor Frankl said, between stimulus and response, there's a space. In that space lies our choice, and in that space lies our humanity. It's between stimulus and response. That's where busha, where positive busha, the kind of busha that's taught in the Sifrei Musar, like an Ishar HaBusha, is about. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about that energizing concept. One other opening thought is Dr. Kobe Francis did a dissertation about 6 months ago on looking at the issue of sexuality and struggles in this area in our community. One of the things he found is secrecy breeds the bad kind of busha. It breeds the kind of paralyzing shame, and it breeds powerlessness, and it breeds actually a breakdown of gedarim. Being able to have a night like this where you name the monster and you talk about it and you figure out what to do and you try to look at it in an active, mature way is exactly what leads to greater senses of control and understanding in terms of finding that balance. It's exactly the bottom line take home message of his the hundreds of pages of research that he wrote about in his study. Let me, before I go into practical recommendations, just share with you a very interesting Kesser Rosh from Rav Chaim Volozhin. It's reprinted in the Siddur HaGra, where he talks about those who were paralyzed with guilt over Hotzah Aser Levatala. And it's interesting, because he criticized those who quote from the Zohar regarding the severity of the sin and the eventual punishment for it, yet neglect to quote the end of the same famous Zohar, which says that there are corrections. There are corrections, like there are always corrections for after the fact. There are sources of tshuva, ranging from Torah study to other kinds of corrections. Here's a rough translation of his quotes. He says, "Those chassidim," meaning machmirim, "who are stringent and state that there is no correcting this sin, they are the ones who induce an increase of sinning among us and cause people to distance themselves from Hashem, since the sinner, when he hears that there is no tshuva for the sin, will abandon all attempts to improve himself. These chassidim cause the Shechina to go into galus, and rather than be called chassidim, should more properly be called chaserim, and their punishment will be very severe." He turns it on its head. It's an unbelievable quote, right? Unbelievable. Because what he's saying and what he's recognizing in his brilliance is that there's always a fine line that we're walking in talking about this issue between validation of the struggle, as Rav Tversky just summarized, and understanding the validation is not the same as approval. It's a struggle. It's a struggle. It's part of being alive. It's and we, you know, always the fear of a night like this is that a psychologist will so allay your guilt that you'll say it's fine. And that's not what this is about. It's about validating the struggle in the way that you're not paralyzed and coming up with some recommendations about it. You know, there's a beautiful insights into this in Sidkos Tzadok. Rabbeinu Tzadok talks about struggles in this area. And he often quotes in his writings, Dr. Rosenfeld has pointed this out to me, that he often brings down this beautiful Gemara about Abaya, where famous Gemara in Sukkah that ends with Kol HaGadol Michavero Yitzro Gadol Heimeno. But it's such an interesting Gemara because it brings out this story of two people, a man and a woman, are going on a walk. They're accompanying each other to the end of town, and Abaya follows them. And he is sure that he's going to have to supervise them to stop them from sinning. And he sees they hit the crossroads, and one says goodbye to another, and nothing inappropriate happens. And Abaya says to himself, "If it were I could not have restrained myself from sinning in this area." And when you look at these kinds of things, Rabbeinu Tzadok brings it down because he talks about how sometimes the greater person, the greater the yetzer. And in a discussion about this, he makes a very important point in his introduction to Tikkun HaBrit, where he says that part of being young is there's an incredibly strong yetzer hara in this area. It's part of being alive and part of being a man. But he also says there's also an equally strong desire to do good, to do chesed, and to forge ahead in terms of growth, in terms of your midos, and growth in terms of Torah study. So the same strength can be sublimated, and as he says so brilliantly, it's k'shem shetzarech adam lahamin ba'ashem yisparach, kein tzarech acharkach lahamin ba'atzma. Beautiful way of summarizing his thinking about this, you know? Just like we must believe in Hashem, we also must believe in ourselves. And it's this dialectic that I think we just heard Rav Tversky talk about, and I want to lead into three sets of recommendations. We talked about this before, I think, was it last year? Right back in 2 years ago. Okay, so it's a new group of guys, although I see some of the people were here last time. So it'll be Chazara for you. But let me just focus on three global areas. Number one is goal setting, the power of goal setting. It says in Mishle, Be'ein Chazon Yifara'am. Without that vision thing, without that goal thing, you sort of dwindle away. You need goals. And what the research shows is that there's a tremendous power in terms of the first step in this, is to actually graph your behavior. It actually says that to the extent that you get specific about what your goals are, right? The Pizesna Rebbe would have 6-month plans with his Talmidim. But here in this case, specifically say, here's where I want to go. Where do I want to go? What are my goals in this area? And to be specific about it. So maybe saying, in terms of the personal gedarim, as we just heard that the Mesillas Yesharim talks about, that if your personal gedar might be that you need to get covenant eyes for your computer, or you might need to get a monitoring program or a filtering program, or to maybe get rid of the computer from your room and only work on it in the library, or whatever it might be, get specific about it. Don't talk about it in a general way. The more general we are in our goal setting, the less likely it is to happen. What the research shows is if you say, for example, if you say, I'm going to study this week for midterms, you're not likely to study. If you change it and you say that on Tuesday night when I get back from class, I'm going to spend an hour reviewing this and that, and then the next hour doing such and such, and you actually get specific about it, as concrete as that sounds, it actually makes it much more likely it'll happen. And that's true in these areas also. Go from vague, amorphous guilt that paralyzes to more specific kind of plans for implementation about what you want to do different, when, and how, because it makes it much more likely it's going to happen. So it's that goal setting thing is very important. And the power of monitoring. In some research studies, just recording and graphing a behavior with no other intervention leads to much improved control of that behavior. Now, I don't know exactly how you would do that in this area, and it probably depends on yourself, but even if you're just doing it in your mind, that you're really working on it, and you're thinking about it, and you're getting specific about it, really makes a difference. Something that I talked about last time is probably the point that most guys said they found most helpful when I talked to them later about this, is changing the way you frame this from threat to challenge. Okay? All the research shows this. If you view something that's going on as a threat, and you view it again as a sign that you're a bad and awful and horrible person, and it paralyzes you, so every time you feel that impulse, you feel more and more demoralized, you're much less likely to act, and a state of yiyush takes over. Okay? If instead you frame it to a challenge, and you change it into what's wrong with me to what am I going to do about it? This is a challenge. I could do it. I've done it in the past. Just that cognitive shift in your mindset from threat to challenge is probably one of the most effective things you could do. It's true in life in general, that to the extent that I guess that you're going from a go roll to a yiud moment, to talk about the way the Rav would talk about this, it's the same idea. You go, you say, look, this is my challenge in life. That's part of being alive. Nothing unusual about it. You're not alone. One of the things Dr. Francis found in his study was that people were feeling so alone with this that it totally undermined their ability to focus and to get control. So that's another piece. So that was the second main point I wanted to make. The third main point I want to make has to do with just a simple finding, and that's that self-control is a muscle. It gets tired. And we have to understand, as Rutorsky said, that the more stressed out we are, the more likely we are to be nichshol in these areas. So that if you're depressed, it's far more likely, and I don't mean depression with a capital D, where you're like majorly depressed and you know, you are really not functioning. I mean, even depressed with a small D, you have a minor setback, you get a bad grade, or what I find is very often it's in the middle of exams when you're just like incredibly stressed out. That's when it's more likely to happen, because self-control takes a certain amount of energy. And again, it's like a muscle. And to the extent that you could predict it and build in those extra gedarim at those times, could be incredibly important. And then another point before I get to handling setbacks, which is the last point I want to make before I end with the story, is that something that I know we talked about last time, but it's very important to talk about, and that's that to the extent that you keep telling yourself not to think of a pink elephant, if we close the eyes of the lights in this room, okay, and I ask everybody to close your eyes and let's spend the next 5 minutes not thinking of a pink elephant, what will happen? What makes much more sense is the Yinanelo Rosha, right? The riding the wave. So that instead of fighting, you do the Shmirah Sinayim, you do everything you can ahead of time, but if a thought keeps coming back to you, the answer probably isn't to just focus on saying avoid it. It'll probably strengthen that thought. Instead, what you need to do to the extent that you can, and I know this isn't easy, but I'll try to be specific, is you tell yourself that you're going to ride the wave. You're going to, the kind of statements you say to yourself, and I know that this is a little difficult, is you try to shift your attention towards a new activity. You basically mentally step back. Don't analyze. The key is not to analyze. If you allow yourself to get into a whole chain of thought, what's wrong with me? How could I stop myself from doing it? It's equivalent of thinking of a pink elephant. If instead you step back and say, okay, this is my challenge. This is what that Chazal says about that we just heard about is, what is it? Ein lecha davar b'chol tara kula shukasha l'rofa am l'frosh elam in harayas v'abiyas haseros. This is part of being alive. Part of being alive. This is it. And if instead of beating yourself up and getting pulled into a struggle with yourself, don't think about it. Sometimes it'll happen to me. I'm in with somebody and I tell myself, don't say this, and it makes it more likely it'll come out. Or don't think about it. It just brings it on. So if instead you separate yourself from it, and you ride the wave, meaning that you just say, oh, here it is. Okay, I know this. This is part of being human. I'm going to do my best to think about something else. It's a sign to me to bring it, to build in those extra gedara. That is far more effective. So don't analyze. Take specific actions to try to distract yourself or get involved in something else, which you could practice. It gets better with time. The beginning, the research shows, is toughest. It's hardest at the beginning to change behaviors in this area, but after a while, you get better at it. I think there are some priests, possibly, who really pull off celibacy, possibly, by actually, you get better at it with time. We know plenty of people aren't, but there are probably some subset that do what they're supposed to do, or what they think they're supposed to do. Okay. So, the final point I want to make, and then I'll end with a kind of a mini example story, is a key. And this is, again, just building on everything that Rutorsky said with so much deeper wisdom of Torah, is how you handle setbacks is key. To handle setback not as something that means that you'll be pulled further into a state of yish, but to change it from setback to feedback. And to do what psychologists call a chain analysis. A chain analysis is something where you just do an analysis of what happened just before. This could be if you're going out and you're pulled into physical activity with the girl you're going out with. Or it could be more in terms of Seser Levatola issues. Try to analyze what's happening just before. Okay? What's the prompting event? What is it when you're most likely to do it? What's happening in your room? Who's around? Who's not around? What's happening in terms of stressors in your life? So you try to do a list of when are you most vulnerable, what times of day, what kinds of emotional states. And then when you do a chain analysis, part of what you do is you then change it from just that analysis into action. So after there is a setback, which is part of what happens in life. When there's a setback, you say to yourself, okay, how can I shift it next time in terms of changing that chain to make something different at any point in the chain? Okay, and there's a whole list of questions that you could ask yourself, but that's what I mean by specific goal setting that'll take you into a better place. Let me end with just an interesting event that I experienced last year. There was a Yom Iyun for shul rabbis, 40 shul rabbis in California, that I was asked to do on marriage, pastoral stuff having to do with marriage. But they had some funding where they were able to do a survey of marriages. And one of the things that they did in the survey of marriages was we were able to do a survey of, turned out we looked at 1,500 marriages. It was an internet-based survey. And one of the things that came out was that the overwhelming majority, and we're doing it in a much more expanded way now, hopefully to get a more accurate read, but 1,500 was a nice snapshot of marriages in our community. And among our findings, we asked, for example, if you could marry the same person over again, would you? The vast majority of people said yes. A totally anonymous survey. There's no way to break the code. We asked people how satisfied you are with your marriage, and 88% said they were either very satisfied or extremely satisfied. But they still fought. There were things they fought about, which is an interesting other talk in terms of the kinds of, that's a whole other issue. And the six top things are what the topics of the Yom Iyun was about this year, last year and this year. But one of the things that hit me as I was looking at the global data was that what I always thought might have been maybe that there's a much lower divorce rate in our community, because there is, Baruch Hashem, much lower. If it's hovering around 50% in the general community, I don't know of any study that says that we have any more than 10%. And it may be much lower than that. And certainly, it's a fraction of what it is in the general community. So everybody says, well, it's because it's a shanda, people are worried about the stigma of divorcing. And I started to think maybe it's because our marriages are working, and a rabbi in the audience tells me the following story. He said, he had been at a all-day training by one of the leading marital therapists in the country in Los Angeles the week before. And the psychologist, who's this world-renowned psychologist, expert in marital therapy, said, you know something? He said, in ancient times, they used to have something set up where people would be physical for only part of the month, and the other part of the month, they weren't physical at all. He said, if we could reconstruct that in today's society, says, of course it's impossible, but if we could reconstruct it, he said, I think the divorce rate would go down to much, much less. There wouldn't be affairs, things would be much better. So the rabbi raises his hand, and he says, Doctor, I just want to tell you that we still do this in the Orthodox Jewish community. In fact, my whole synagogue does it. So the doctor looks, he says, please, Rabbi, nobody does that nowadays. And if you're sitting there, they're telling you they do it. Get real. Get real. There's no way that they do it. So Rabbi said, I do it. In my life, I do it. He said, nobody talked to him for the rest of the day. Maybe staying away from him. But I think there's incredible beauty and power in all of these gedarim and everything that comes up. In fact, there's a lot of very strong evidence that shows that to the extent that we work on ourselves in this area, it brings us happiness in many other areas in life. And actually, in terms of the physical relationships that you ultimately get in the right context, there's much higher levels of enjoyment than people get when they don't have these gedarim. Very interesting research on this. So all of this ultimately, the wisdom behind it is something that you'll experience, God willing, on a regular basis. But again, to go back to the wisdom that we're talking about, I think that that just to understand this and to find the tension and the balance between, on the one hand, understanding the importance of control and the psychology of control, tempered with a good understanding of the dangers of Yish, probably is the way we need to go with this.